This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Vermont legislature is currently debating a bill that would require companies to label genetically modified products that are sold in Vermont. Senate President Pro Tem John Campbell says he's confident the state would win any lawsuits brought by food producers angered over Vermont's requirements. But to protect taxpayers from a multi-million dollar bill if the state lost, Campbell says the Senate version has a backup plan.
Just to make sure that the taxpayers are not, you know, looking at the, you know, taking a hit if this does what we've done, instead of putting triggers in there, we've said that we are taking any of the suits that the Attorney General's office or any enforcement actions that the state Attorney General's office has for the next 2 years will be going into a special fund.
Attorney General Bill Sorrell helped work on that funding plan, but he has said in the past that he favors the approach put forward by the House of Representatives, making the law effective only once a quorum of other states have enacted similar legislation, what John Campbell just called a trigger. GMO labeling is just one of the complicated political topics the Attorney General is dealing with right now. And today on the program, Bill Sorrell joins me to go through a few of them. Welcome back, Attorney General.
Oh, great to be here, Jane. Thanks.
Regarding that GMO labeling, the House version had triggers. The Senate version doesn't. So should it go through all the way to the Senate, they're going to have to reconcile those. But the Senate version, as we just heard, sets up a fund if and when the state is sued over the labeling law that the state could use to defend itself. Where do you stand on that? What, do you prefer the trigger or do you prefer a fund to pay for litigation costs?
It's two different things, and let me first say about the trigger. The House only has a mini trigger. The House says that the bill or the law would be effective July 1 of next year unless at an earlier time two states enact similar legislation. So under the House version, the law would take effect July 1 of 2015 or some earlier date if two states pass similar laws. In the Senate, they push back the effective date. I believe it's to July 1 of 2016. But the Senate doesn't say anything about a trigger of other states. So the House only has a mini trigger. The Senate has none. What I objected to was an idea that was bandied about in the Senate to create this fund that would be used to pay our costs of defending the law if there's a lawsuit against the state, and also if we were to lose, to have the millions of dollars or potentially millions of dollars that we would have to pay in attorney's fees, because in all likelihood – a lawsuit would be based on constitutional protections, and if we lose those kinds of cases, we have to pay the other side's attorney's fees. What I objected there was not to private citizens or organizations contributing money to the state to use to satisfy a judgment against the state or to just pay the state's costs of defending the law. But what I thought was wrong was to say that the law won't go into effect unless or until that fund gets to X million dollars. And I thought that was very bad policy going forward, that a law wouldn't be go into effect until private citizens or organizations had funded the state's defense. My view is if the legislature wants to require something to be in state statute, whether it's GMO labeling or something else, then the state should stand behind the law and they could use money that's contributed, but the statute would be effective by a date certain that the legislature sets.
And regardless of the fund and how full it was.
That's right. I think it's just bad policy. I mean, you could get outside the GMO area. Let's say it's something else, abortion issues, something in the criminal justice arena, something in the environmental protection arena. And the legislature says, well, this is going to be the law of the state if Vermonters or others contribute enough money to a fund that we can defend the law we think should go into effect. I just think that's bad policy. And this Senate, I'm pleased to say, did not put a a trigger like that in the bill as it looks like it's going to come out of the Senate.
You and I have talked about GMO labeling in past years as well. I believe you've told me you anticipate a lawsuit should Vermont pass this kind of law.
I'll be very surprised if we are not sued if the legislature goes ahead and enacts a mandatory GMO labeling statute. A lot of people might not realize that this is arguably a free speech issue. And let's set aside the fact that the vast majority of Vermont consumers, myself included, think that on labeling, on labels of consumer products that we're buying, we want to know what's in those products or not in those products. So let's set that issue aside. But this is a free speech issue because required labeling is so-called compelled speech. The industry, the food industry, will be required to communicate, to say things on their labels. And so there will be a balancing act that a court will, if there's a lawsuit, someday go through a process of balancing the governmental interest in requiring the industry to speak to advise customers of what's in their products. How strong and valid is that public interest as opposed to that overrides the right of the industry to otherwise not speak, to be silent? And Vermont has had some experience in this area. Shortly before my time as Attorney General, the Vermont legislature passed a statute that required labeling of dairy products that contained fluid milk from cattle that had been or cows that had been given bovine growth hormone. And the legislature passed a statute requiring the labeling of those products. Similarly, a few years later, the Vermont legislature kind of led the country and passed a statute that required labeling of consumer products that contained mercury. Vermont was sued in both cases. We ultimately won in one of those cases. One statute was upheld and we lost in the other. We won on mercury because the court found that clearly mercury is essentially a poison. It's hugely toxic, and there was a legitimate government interest in consumers knowing that the products they were buying contained mercury. On the other hand, we lost and the bovine growth hormone labeling statute was struck down because the court found that there wasn't sufficiently compelling evidence of risk or harm from products containing bovine growth hormone, and consequently the governmental interest did not outweigh the First Amendment protection of the dairy industry. So our law was struck down there. So if and when we're sued over a GMO labeling bill, we'll have to see what the complaint looks like, what the arguments are. But I wouldn't be surprised if they're constitutional claims, they're compelled free speech claims, they're burden on interstate commerce claims. And that weighing process will be part of the equation. But we will do our level best if the legislature passes a statute to get the experts that we need and do the research and make the very best case we can to uphold the law and have this be more of a mercury law outcome than a bovine growth hormone law outcome.
But what about that money? I mean, if a bill passes with – even if the Senate bill passed as it stands now and the state was somehow sued before there was money in that fund, where would you get it from? I mean, we've had high-profile lawsuits that you've been dealing with and, you know, having to come up with that money if we lost – where do you advise us going as a state?
Well, the Senate is saying that excess recoveries from successful enforcement actions by my office over I think 700 and something thousand dollars will go into this fund, fill the fund. If there are private contributions, those will be used first. There's going to be money in that fund. I mean, if our office brings tens of millions of dollars a year into the state from successful enforcement actions. And so the money will be there. I mean, just in the 19 months from July 1st of 2012 through January of this year, our office brought in just under $60 million. Now, not all of that would go into this consumer recovery. Tobacco money and others are already spoken for, but there will be millions of dollars that will be available from successful recovery actions by us well before any litigation has been completed. We might need an appropriation of some money to in the interim, but I think that's actually unlikely.
We're talking today with Attorney General Bill Sorrell. We've been looking at the potential for lawsuits over a GMO labeling law currently moving through the legislature. We're also going to speak with him about Vermont Yankee decommissioning, patent trolling, and other issues that you see on the table that you'd like to talk about. And you can give a call to the Attorney General by dialing 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or leave a question on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Attorney General Sorrell, we've gotten a couple of emails about patent trolling. Jerry Tarrant, the founder and COO of MyWeb Grocer, emailed in to say, Vermont companies, large and small, for-profit and not-for-profit, have been targeted by these unscrupulous groups who are doing the patent trolling. At MyWeb Grocer, we've spent well over $100,000 dealing with these groups, but the cost has been far greater. None have proven that the services we provide for our customers infringe on any patents, but that hasn't stopped them from demanding large sums of money in exchange for not suing us or our customers. And Bill in Burlington emailed to say, I'd like to thank Attorney General Sorrell on all the great work he's done around patent trolls, particularly his support of fee shifting in the federal bill. I was wondering what other provisions, if any, will make for a strong federal bill to fight patent trolls. Also, why do we need strong federal legislation when the state has already done so much on this issue? And maybe you could pick it up there from there, Attorney General Sorrell, because you are actually in Washington this week to testify at a House subcommittee about patent trolling.
Yes, Congressman Welch's subcommittee of the House Commerce Committee had a hearing on abusive demand letters in the patent arena, and I was asked to testify and speak from the perspective of the attorneys general in the country. And this is really a bipartisan, nonpartisan issue for attorneys general. Earlier this year, with the Nebraska AG, I co-authored a letter to the Senate leadership. 42 states signed on, and saying that if the Congress is going to enact legislation in this arena, what's hugely important to the states is that we not be preempted, that we not be prohibited from enforcing our own statutes, whether our traditional consumer protection acts. I filed a lawsuit against a notorious alleged troll for sending letters to small businesses and nonprofits in the state of Vermont. Well, that same entity, it sent over 16,000 small businesses and nonprofits in all 50 states similar letters. And I filed the first of its kind in the nation lawsuit against this troll. We're now in federal court fighting to get it back in state court. But there are those that think that and then our legislature, Jerry Tarrant and other prominent business leaders in Vermont supported legislation that our legislature enacted for a first of its kind, the nation specific statute against, quote, bad faith assertions of patent infringement. Well, those and now four or five other states, Utah, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Oregon have enacted similar Vermont style laws. There are a number of other state legislatures considering them. Those laws are at risk because the patent system is a federal system, and there are some strong interests that believe that states should not be allowed to assert themselves into the patent arena. And the lawsuit that we have pending that we're fighting right now, that company is saying that we're outright preempted, that my lawsuit is invalid, and that we don't have any jurisdiction or authority over them as state regulators because patents are solely creatures of federal statute. So that's an issue, and that's among the things I was talking about before the House Commerce Committee this week saying whatever you do, abusive demand letters are a big problem. They affect the MyWeb grocers and they affect the nonprofits like Lincoln Street in Springfield, Vermont that provides services to developmentally disabled Vermonters, lives solely on state and federal funding, a really small operation. This is a problem. The states have a real role in enforcing our consumer protection acts against those who engage in unfair and deceptive acts and practices in commerce. And just because it's under the umbrella of a patent assertion doesn't mean that state consumer protection acts have no validity.
And that's how you've tried to get around or sidestep this issue of patents being solely under federal jurisdiction, is saying that you are going after these patent trolls for consumer protection violations.
Yes.
And just to clarify as well for people who are, you know, picturing some warty, ugly fellow under the bridge, the patent trolling is when these companies send out letters to any company, but you mentioned small companies in Vermont, for example, saying, yes, you are falling afoul of our patent for the way that you're using this product and we need you to pay for it. And it could be anything from, you know, using technology that's pretty widely available,
just
like Wi-Fi or
scanning. Yeah. Wi-Fi and small banks are getting these demand letters saying your ATM machines violate our patents. And typically, the troll is certainly a negative term. It's for those that buy up largely unused patents. They buy them very cheaply, and then they take very expansive views as to what those patents control, and they try to force, some say extort, money from companies and small and large nonprofits to say, you have to pay us in order to be able to continue to violate in order to get permission to violate our patent.
So you spoke to the federal government, to this House subcommittee, to say, you know, you don't want state laws to be preempted by any laws the federal government makes. We want to move on to other topics, but just briefly, so what are you hoping would be in federal legislation specifically?
We're hoping that there will be requirements of more transparency when these demand letters are sent. For example, the company we're suing has 40 shell subsidiary we thought 40. We're now hearing 80 shell subsidiary corporations. So we want to know at the time that the demand letter is sent that who really owns the patent, who's behind this, and who's going to benefit if there are payments made. Secondarily, we want a requirement that there be a specific investigation of the alleged patent abuser and not just sending thousands and tens of thousands of these demand letters willy-nilly out. I mean, at least one of the entities in Vermont that got these letters that said you're scanning documents and attaching them to email and that violates our patent, at least one of the entities in Vermont didn't even have a scanning machine. So there was absolutely no investigation there. We want to know if this patent has been struck down, has been ruled invalid by an administrative proceeding or a judicial proceeding. We want that information to be provided at the time of the demand letter. But we're on the Senate side now. The House is going to take it up, but the Senate is in markup, so-called markup right now of different bills in the patent reform arena. And we're fighting hard in the Senate to see that the states are not preempted. We're going to see how that bill comes out. Then there's going to have to be a conference committee between the House and the Senate. But this testimony I gave earlier this week is just another potential vehicle that maybe there'll be a separate House bill, not on general patent reform, but on these abusive demand letters. So that's another opportunity for us to continue the fight if what comes out of the Congress on the bills that are in the Senate right now don't expressly allow us to continue to stand up for Vermont consumers by enforcing our Consumer Protection Act and the new statute that was passed by the legislature.
So we'll have to wait and see on that federal legislation on patents and patent trolling. We're talking today with Attorney General Bill Sorrell. We're going to look at other issues coming right up, Vermont Yankee decommissioning. We've got a question from a listener about hemp. We're going to get to many more of your questions as well in the second half of our conversation with Attorney General Bill Sorrell. You can ask a question by posting it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. or by calling 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're speaking with Attorney General Bill Sorrell. We've looked at GMO labeling. We've looked at patent trolling. We're going to talk about other issues that are on listeners' minds, as well as some of the other things that the Attorney General is dealing with right now. And if you have a question for the AG, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or if you're on Facebook, you can go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and post your question there. We got a note from Nataka in Salisbury who says the federal farm bill has made it legal for hemp research in Vermont, but it's also created confusion among University of Vermont and Agency of Agriculture officials. Kentucky's Attorney General Jack Conway recently cleared up the question about processing and marketing hemp grown for research in Kentucky. Are you aware of the confusion and concerns at our Agency of Agriculture and among UVM's attorneys and researchers regarding the new federally sanctioned hemp research? And are there steps your office could take to help this situation?
I am not aware of the complexities of the issue, but I do have an assistant attorney general who works full-time for the Agency of Agriculture, and this afternoon I'll try to find out the situation.
Would you mind sending us an email when you have information on that, and we'll put it up on the Vermont Edition Facebook page?
I'd be happy to.
Great. Okay, so Nataka, we'll try to get back to you on hemp research and confusion in the federal bill. Attorney General Sorrell, let's move on to Vermont Yankee and talk a little bit about that. Vermont Yankee is on schedule to shut down at the end of this year. And we were speaking recently with the state and with a spokesman for Entergy about an agreement the state had reached with the company. Entergy has said that it would like to use some of its decommissioning fund monies for moving spent fuel at the Vernon plant from cooling pools into dry cask storage. The company says this is absolutely part of why the decommissioning fund is there. It's within the boundaries of what the fund can be used for. It will need to apply for a special permit from the NRC to do that, but it says it's going to apply and it expects to get that. You've said you're going to sue Entergy if they do that. Why?
I didn't say I would sue Entergy. I said that we, that is Vermont, would likely object to those uses of the decommissioning fund to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's interesting that you say that the Entergy spokesperson said that they need a, quote, special permit to be able to use the decommissioning fund for these spent fuel purposes. And it's true.
I may have misspoken on permit, but I know they do need to get permission from the NRC.
You're right. Okay. They do need it. Because they don't have the automatic right to do it. They need to an exception, if you will, from the NRC to using the fund for that purpose. And we'll see when it happens and exactly what the request is. But the bottom line is here that Vermont is going to be very vigilant about attempts to use the decommissioning fund as some sort of cookie jar that will withdraw funds from the decommissioning fund. It's going to cost roughly $1 billion to do decommissioning, plus or minus. Right now, that fund has about $620 million in it or so. Entergy is not planning on putting any more new money into the fund. They're going to allow it to grow from returns on the funds being invested. And so we have to get from $620 million to roughly $1 billion before decommissioning can really start in earnest. And so if Vermont Yankee is allowed to pull for some period of time, some extended period of time, let's say $150 million or so to deal with spent fuel, then it's going totally the wrong way. And you then have a lot less money in the fund, so it would take longer to earn to get up to $1 billion. And I know the governor and most Vermonters want an environmentally safe but as quick as feasible as possible decommissioning of the Vermont Yankee site, so that it will be not present any harm to people or the environment, But second of all, that site could be used for other purposes and hopefully economic development purposes in the southeastern part of the state. So we're going to be vigilant and try to weigh in when there are requests to use the funds for other than decommissioning, because that will delay the time period for the fund to get to $1 billion so we can move forward with actual decommissioning.
But why isn't that part of decommissioning in your mind? They have to move it, or they don't have to, but they plan to move it into dry cask storage for longer-term storage.
Because under current law, that is not considered an expense of decommissioning.
So what Entergy has said is that they would likely take that money out of the fund to pay for the cost of moving to dry cask storage. And then they expect to be reimbursed by the federal government for what they've taken out, because they say it's under the federal government's purview for that long-term storage. So why isn't that acceptable if the fund would then be reimbursed?
Because it's a question of how long that money is out of the fund, because the fund is not going to be earning anything on the monies that are withdrawn during the period that it's out. And so the other side of the coin, Jane, is it's not just Entergy that we have been and will be interacting with, but we will continue to engage with federal regulators. And so if at some point in time Entergy is allowed to take X millions of dollars out of the fund to deal with spent fuel, then we are going to be working very hard with the help of our congressional delegation to see that the federal government repays Vermont Yankee, because it's a federal responsibility to deal with the spent fuels under federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, if Vermont Yankee is allowed to use decommissioning funds for these spent fuel purposes, then it will behoove us to encourage the federal government to make the repayment very promptly to Vermont Yankee so the money can go back into the fund. But there's precedent elsewhere where it is years and years that these monies are out of decommissioning funds before the federal government stands up and accepts its responsibility and repays the companies, and the monies can go back in the fund. So we've got interest both ways, with Vermont Yankee being able to use the funds for those purposes, and if they are allowed to use the funds for those purposes, then Vermont has a great incentive to see the federal government meet its financial responsibilities, pay the money back promptly so it can go back in the fund, and the fund can start growing again to that roughly $1 billion number we're looking at.
And what ability do you have to compel the parties in either of those situations beyond saying, please, oh, please?
You're asking a lawyer, Jane, and so we will be aggressive and take advantage of all persuasion.
But you said not sue. When I characterized your response as saying you would sue Entergy, you said no, that's not quite right.
Well, because the federal government is the entity that's going to make the ultimate decision as to whether Entergy is able to use the fund for those purposes.
So it's the federal government that you'd have to try to compel?
Yes.
We have
to persuade not to allow the fund to be used for those purposes. So, you know, we're talking about issues that are potentially years down the road. The spent fuels have to cool enough to be able to remove them, to put them into storage. Even the most optimistic of estimates of the length of time it's going to take to fully decommission Vermont Yankee, if we had $1 billion in the fund today, estimates are 13 to 23, 25 years. So it's nothing that's going to happen overnight, but the state, we've moved to fighting with Entergy about their continued operation. They're going to close at the end of this year. One of the benefits they gave the state in this agreement that we have is they have 2 years after they close to do a site-specific assessment of what it's going to take to decommission this fund, this site, and they've agreed to complete that site-specific assessment by the end of this year. So 2 years earlier than they're required to do. And that will be a public document, and we're all going to have an idea of what decommissioning is going to look like cost-wise and process-wise as of either the end of this year or very early next year.
Let's give maybe a final question here to Hannah, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Hannah. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Sorrell.
Hi, Hannah.
Calling in regards to the drug epidemic that has been sweeping across Vermont the last several years, and haven't heard much from you or your office regarding this, and I wanted to know specifically what your office and you are doing. Are you meeting with community leaders? Are you meeting with mayors? Have you talked to anybody that's actually been deeply involved with this?
And Hannah, thanks for the question, Attorney General.
I'm surprised you say that you're not of the view that our office has been aggressive in this arena. I spoke at the premiere of Bess O'Brien's film about drug addiction in
Vermont.
That's
called The Hungry Heart, I believe, right?
Yes. And we have been doing the major drug prosecutions that don't – we have full-time assistant AGs with the Northern and Southern Drug Task Forces, cases that don't go to the federal government. We're doing the lion's share of those prosecutions. But I have said publicly repeatedly – that law enforcement has an important role in fighting the scourge of addiction in Vermont, but the importance of the law enforcement role it pales compared to the need for effective, more effective treatment systems for those regimens, for those who are addicted, and particularly prevention, more education so that people don't use these highly addictive drugs, whether heroin or prescription drugs, because they can be so addictive and they just ruin people's lives.
Attorney General Bill Sorrell, thanks for talking to us today about some of the topics that you're working on and answering some of our listeners' questions. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Coming up on this program, we're going to chat with Northeast Kingdom poet Leland Kinsey. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his latest book of poetry, Leland Kinsey continues to explore the themes of family, time, and landscape that have occupied his previous works. They serve him well as he examines the Northeast Kingdom he lives in that his family has called home for generations. Leland Kinsey joins me now to talk about the new collection called Winter Ready. Such a pleasure to have you back in the studio. Thanks,
Leland. Thank you very much.
You begin this collection up on your roof, fixing a crumbling chimney. And in the second poem, which sort of continues on from the first poem, you talk about the chimney swifts that surprise you by flying out of the chimney, almost knocking you off your ladder. And I love the image that you create of these birds when they decide to come back into the chimney, and you call it like smoke returning. It looks like smoke returning. And you write, I could hear the scratching of their small claws and bristly bracing tails, the small sound and tiny echo of their twittering calls. And then you talk about finding nestlings sort of half buried in the ash and not knowing what to do. I found that image so chilling. I mean, it just chills me to think about it now. It was a really beautiful way to start off this collection.
Thank you. It is startling when it's after breeding season that they collect in these huge flocks. And so it surprises one if one's working on the chimney and they emerge. And then earlier in the season, when occasionally, not very often do they fall out of the nest, but it does happen, and you find them down in the ash pit, and there's little you can do at that point because you're not going to be able to get them back in the nest like a robin or something. So
what do you do? Do you kill them?
They die. You put them out and, you know, hope they might be big enough to call, but it's not going to happen.
Given the season that we're in, I was hoping maybe you could read from another of the poems in this collection called Double Digging the Garden.
I will. Double Digging the Garden. The first shovel depth turns easily, a fine built loam of native soil, and the manure, leaves, wood, stove cinders, garden debris, kitchen garbage, and that heat of their own accord at the middle of the compost pile and burn to a fine gray ash, which I forked steaming in the late fall air into the wheelbarrow to spread on the plot before I begin my tilt. I build a berm as I spade the first trench. The second shovel depth is hard to turn, a remnant of the glacial till pushed by ice and dropped as heavy sediment in the great plowing of this region. but I want some clay in my topsoil and a deeper richness in the bed to hold water and nourish in summer drought. I want crops like my uncle's field corn that once stood 14 foot, French white radishes like baseballs, enough cucumbers for 4 kinds of pickles plus relish, tomatoes for sauce, juice, piccalilli, and eating out of hand, lettuces like thick knots making up a variegated carpet in hues from green to reds. My wife and I now have way too much of all of this, our children gone. Pets, large and small, which used to consume the extra, have long since died. I squeeze, can, freeze, dry. My grandmother had jars of raspberries dated a decade old. I may soon match that mark with many supplies. I give much away, will have to give more, to extended family, neighbors, food banks. I could join the farmer's market, but don't like meeting new people. My legacy may consist of refuse. By the turn of mid-afternoon, my spine feels bent and raised like the spade's frog. For 2 brisk days, heated by work, I fill the ditch just dug with the diggings of the new all the way to the end of my tillage, then barrel the levee at the start down to fill the last. The soil lies loose, aerated, and free of any rocks that deep frost forced up. It will drain and open easily in spring for cold hardy crops, and warm quickly for fainter seeds. Each summer I bring friends out to note and share the display and produce. Here is life's habit on grand exhibit, and the hard work hidden.
Boy, you've encapsulated a whole season that we have to come here. I know in the Northeast Kingdom, you're probably not quite tilling the garden yet.
We are not.
I want to underline or highlight that line, too, in the poem, which I just love. I could join the farmer's market, but don't like meeting new people. That can't be entirely true. You've had to feed your poetry habit by doing a lot of things that incorporate interacting with other people, including a lot of teaching.
I have done a great deal of teaching, but that doesn't mean it's ever easy. It's something that I think is important to do, but it's always hard to do.
Really? So you really don't like meeting new people?
Not especially.
You know, in this poetry collection, I loved all the images, and you really do, as you have in past collections, shown a real connection to the landscape and the land. But it made me think, boy, Leland Kinsey never has to do anything so mundane as open a can of beans that he bought at the grocery store or go to the grocery store in the first place. I mean, you make life sound very rural and pastoral, and the mundane for you is so different than the mundane for many, many people.
It's probably more similar than I would like to admit even. But certainly my long heritage brings something to the writing that I hope comes through. I do hope that in addition to that, there is a universality to it, however, so it's not limited by it, but it just helps expand it into a wider realm.
You were very kind to me when I first came back to Vermont to take this job, and I came and interviewed you at your home in Barton, and then you took me around the neighborhood, as it were, and took me up to this hill where there was a rock, sort of a rock outcropping, and you sat on that rock and you said, I could throw a stone and hit a Kinsey. You know, any direction I throw a stone from here, it's probably somebody that I'm related to. How does that color your relationship to the landscape that you're writing about? Do you feel ownership, or is it something lighter than that?
It's not ownership, but it's a depth of association. It's a historical depth and a cultural depth. And then the familial is part of that, but just a part of that. And so it, even in my family, it goes beyond that. And that particular rock is actually not an outcrop. It's one that the glacier – an erratic that the glacier just brought to
there
and set there.
Would you read another poem for us? There are several that I really love, but I think The Spawning Hole might be a nice one to read.
The Spawning Hole. Because an older friend of his would mention it, but never reveal location, my friend found the river's major brook trout spawning hole for at least the second time by walking the Aldery reaches, field meanders, rocky rapids and marshy spans, greenstone and granite defiles too narrow to fish, boulder-strewn flats, slate-bedded runs, sand and gravel-tailed pools over the course of several falls. One mist-defined October morning, he walked up on the older man frying two brook trout beside a lively curve and race near Beaver Work. "It's taken you a while. I've cooked one up for you." Only once or twice a year do we drift our weighted flies out beside overgrown banks, over twig and leaf deposits, heading the clear gravel run. We click quickly land and release all females, and the largest males, crook-jawed and shimmering, with muscle and color, giving them the weight, feel, and shine of an ingot. But we keep one or two medium males apiece, because our families like to eat trout, and to keep it all from being just sport.
Can you live in the Northeast Kingdom and not feel a connection to the landscape like that in some way?
It's probably possible, but I wouldn't know how you would do it. For newcomers, they may not. If you go to and reside in one of the small cities and have a technical job, you might not, or it might take you a while. After a while, I think at some point you would begin to, but it might take that while.
And if you're likely Lynn Kinsey, you can even find the poetry in Slaughtering Turkeys, which is also included in this. The poem that you just read, The Spawning Hole, that whole first part of the poem, I love the way you wrote that because you're talking about this stream and you can feel in your writing tumbling over those rocks that are pooling up and tumbling themselves with the flow of the water. How do you think about the structure of your poetry in conveying an image like that?
Very carefully. I take a great deal of time because any of the rivers up there do have this wide variety of type within its entire run. And a lot of people don't realize that. They'll see the open and accessible parts and not realize that all these other parts are there. And, of course, that has truths in other areas besides rivers. But I think of that, but I want to keep it to the image itself, too. And so I want the description to be complete. I want it to move easily. I will often say these lines out loud as I'm writing them to make sure they are understandable and will convey what I want them to convey.
So if you were writing about a different part of that stream, you would write that poem differently?
The pace would probably be different.
Do you have an example of that that you can think of? I'm sorry, I'm putting you on the spot
right
here.
Not right offhand, no.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I'd love for you, in the time we have left, to tell the story of the poem Deer Camp, because it's a long poem and we don't have time to read it, but it's a kind of a wonderful story going back in time.
The Deer Camp exists on a small plot of land over near the Connecticut River. It's in an undeveloped township that my father-in-law bought with seven other World War II veterans when they came back, and all of them had had a tough time. And I helped him, in fact, build that deer camp years later, although they'd earlier used a camp, an old logging camp that now is defunct and long defunct and plowed under. But the land was all open then, and now it's completely overgrown by trees except for the large swamp that the deer camp sits on. And so the poem just tries to encompass the modern reality of the camp sitting on that swamp and the history that encompassed my father-in-law and his World War II service and his memory and difficulty in talking about that service.
The poem is called Deer Camp, The Deer Camp, and it's in the collection Winter Ready. It's Leland Kinsey's new collection of poems. Leland, thank you so much for speaking with us about it today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Leland Kinsey is also going to be reading tonight at Phoenix Books in Burlington at 7, along with poets Daniel Lusk, Karen McCadden, and Angela Patton. He's going to be reading at Book King in Rutland tomorrow evening. And that's it for today. Tomorrow on the program, we'll go through a thorough update on where things stand with the legislative session. Lawmakers have another 4 or 5 weeks to pass the bills they want approved and to scuttle measures they don't. We're going to have some of the state's best state House reporters on to explain the details. So if you have questions about where bills stand and want to hear some good analysis, tune in at noon or send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.